You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and here's the second half of my recent interview with Richard Herring. Let's talk about your stand-up then. Let's talk about your stand-up persona.
Yeah.
What sort of comic, when you came back to stand-up, or even in the very early days, what sort of comedian did you think you'd be? And is that anything like the comedian that you actually are?
I'm not really convinced I've nailed it. And I think in terms of who I am on stage, and I almost deliberately, and again, I think this might be a reason that I'm harder to pin down, in that there is a through line of sort of childishness and erudite childness throughout what I'm doing, and there's a sort of sex obsession, I suppose, throughout all of it, and that sort of childishness. But each of the shows I do are quite different than each other, and you know, some of them would be more full on silly, and some of them would be quite political or serious. And you know, the I suppose the through line is myself, and a lot of it is internally looking at me. But I don't think it's not like I've just created a persona that then can.
Can be applied to situations.
Yeah. So it's slightly different. So like, We're All Gonna Die, this year's show, is quite a different show than Talking Cock, which is more of kind of a lecture all about sex. And this is a bit more of a considered serious show. It's a bit, I'm supposed to, What Is Love Anyway and We're All Gonna Die might be a bit similar, but Hitler Mustache is very different than Crisis in the Bike, which is very different than Oh Fucking 40, you know. So it's tending to find an honesty in, about myself and looking internally in myself mostly. But I don't know. I mean, when I started out doing stand-up the first time in 1989, 1990, I was sort of torn between doing stuff I thought was funny and doing stuff that would get me booked, and therefore usually fell very much between those two stories.
Okay.
I did neither. You know, I either just compromised the interesting stuff I was doing or was just, it wasn't right for what they were doing. So I thought I had an odd thing where, you know, maybe one in three gigs would go pretty well and one in three gigs would go abysmally badly.
Okay.
And usually the owner of the club would see the bad one, and I didn't, you know, I struggled on for a couple of years doing it and wasn't really enjoying it. And I didn't know. Sometimes I did a character, sometimes I did a kind of old man character, sometimes I did just this Somerset character, and sometimes I was myself. So I was really sort of struggling to work out what I was doing with it. And then I think when I came back to doing it, I just sort of decided I was going to do whatever I thought. I don't care. It doesn't matter if I travel around. I booked myself into loads of gigs all around the country, none in London. I think Dan Topolsky just gave me a list of all his contacts, but they were all the non-London ones. I just emailed them all thinking, oh, you know, could you give me a gig? And thinking most of them would say no, or but they obviously all went, yeah, you're Richard Herring, yeah, you can have a gig. I thought I might have to do open spots again, you know, but they actually, so I had this leg up. But everyone booked me, but I just took every gig I was offered without really even looking at the map, and then just drove around the country doing these £100 gigs wherever for a year. You know, I'd drive back from Yorkshire every night, and then I might be, you know, there was no even rhyme or reason to what I was doing. But my decision was just to do what I thought was funny, regardless. And it wasn't really suitable, a lot of it, for stand-up clubs. But it kind of nearly always worked.
In what
way? It was just because it wasn't gags. It was like something was like someone like Jogger or me talking about Rudyard Kipling for 15 minutes. You know, it was sort of odd. Mm-hmm. Subject matter, and not and that, in fact, that's why someone like Jogger routine became so long, was because it would have this bizarre reaction where like a third of the audience loved it and a third of the audience were furiously
I remember seeing that show.
So it was, but they were like, but in a club, less so in Edinburgh, you know, in Edinburgh it didn't happen quite as much. It still happened a bit, but in clubs it was like men like just shouting with absolute anger at me that I was daring to carry on doing this, and then me calmly discussing with them why it was funny or why it wasn't, all, you know, whether I was wrong or they were wrong. And so that, you know, it's just, I guess I just kind of thought, well, you sort of find your way, I suppose. And I think someone like Jogger, it's a show that I really liked. It kind of got some of the worst reviews I've ever had. It got some, you know, got some good reviews. It's the best selling of any of my DVDs, weirdly. I don't know why.
Really?
Yeah. On the Go Faster Stripe. It's one of the early ones, so it might just be that people bought that and never bought anything again. but you know, it's a really interesting show. It's a really brave, and they got, it was the Daily Telegraph worst comedy experience of 2005, mm-hmm. which I'm astonished at, because I think even if you didn't like it, you would go, well, I can see he's attempting something interesting and exciting there.
Yes.
If you're a comedy critic, and to actually say it's just worse than any other.
Yes,
comedy,
absolutely. It's by no means the laziest comedy experience, is it?
Yeah. It's sort of, you know, it's there's interesting stuff in it, even if you don't like it. But but then I think I've just, each year I've just sort of, I think the shows became a little bit, I mean, someone like Menage was a bit more kind of stand up friendly, I think. I think I sort of got through playing around and thought, well, let's actually just try and be funny. I mean, there's an element where I think stretching stuff is funny and doing anti-comedy is funny, but I also think you've got to, I just sort of got fed up of the number of people basically doing comedy about comedy, and thinking, and which includes myself, and thinking, well, actually, the true thing is not to just take the piss out of a bad comedy, but to try and be
to be good.
Because it's very easy to be cynical and snide about everyone else, but I think actually, so I think I sort of moved a little bit in that direction. But I just really like, with stand-up, and with the Edinburgh shows especially, because I mean, with stand-up, I've tended to not write much new material that I can use in clubs, and so it tends to, you know, the same sort of 45 minutes goes on a bit of a loop until I get bored of it, if I'm doing stand-up clubs, which I don't do very much anymore. But I really like putting together an Edinburgh show and being able to take more interesting ideas and more serious ideas and playing with the audience's reaction. You know, I really liked in What Is Love Anyway, the end of that show, where I did a routine about my grandma having Alzheimer's disease, which was, you know, which just really, the audience were kind of, made them cry, made them laugh, and then it made them cry a bit, and then it made them laugh straight away again, and cry with, you know, and cry with laughter and tears, and just the way that kind of, you know, the theatricality of that routine, and of learning how to make that work with an audience and how to play an audience like that, I think was really exciting. So I think it's not just about coming up with good jokes. It's about kind of, I think with those Edinburgh shows, you can sort of play around with theatricality and work out what you can do in terms of being serious as well as being funny. And I really want to be, you know, I like being funny all the way through. I don't really like to do 10 minutes of serious stuff or 10 minutes with no laughs in it, and I really like a show where people are laughing all the way through. But I suppose I'm trying to make, with my shows, I'm trying to make people think about issues. And I suppose as well that I don't, I'm not giving answers to stuff, I think I'm just asking questions, really.
Okay.
So I think that's what I like about it. I don't really like comics who tell you what to think or say you have to believe the same as me, or, you know, you're wrong. I kind of think I'm as confused as anyone else about all this stuff, and let's hear some of the crazy stuff I've thought about it, and let's take, I like taking the logic of things like religion and, you know, the afterlife at the moment. The idea of the afterlife, if you just think about it for a second, it's such a, it's ludicrous that grown-ups believe it and haven't thought through just the practicalities of being eternal. It's just awful, you know, that people go, oh, I can't bear dying, so I'm going to imagine that I live for eternity, which is much worse than dying. That would be just a living hell, you know, an eternity without your body. So you think about these things, but it's not like giving an, I'm not saying I know what happens when you die. I can say I think I know what happens when you die. I think you die, But you know, there's no way any of us know that. So I think it's more about making people think about the questions and thinking about politics and religion and why they think it. And I hope with most of these shows as well that it's not, you know, Christ on a Bike, I think Jesus comes out of that show pretty well, even though all the Christians protested it, they didn't whatever watch the show. But it's about having actually looked at the subject and thought about it, and rather than just knee-jerk one way or the other, to kind of, I suppose, that routine talk about the liberals versus racists, who's more racist, the liberals or the racists. What I love about that routine is it's sort of ambiguously not coming down much on either side. I mean, it's sort of coming down the side that racism's a bad thing, but it's also saying liberalism could be a bit of a shitty thing as well, in its own way, and also just playing around with that, those kind of just the logic of the way we think about stuff.
And in the makeup of, in the structure of one of your hour shows or hour or more, how much of it is in the creation of it, how much of it do you go, well, that's the thing that says something, and it's okay for that bit just to be a daft bit or just to be jokes?
I think nearly all of it's part of it, though. I mean, in the end, it kind of, it sort of happens very organically, and I'll sometimes just chuck stuff around and then suddenly see the link, rather than kind of planning it. And then that, but I like the organic way. And most of the, when you do a show, when, at the end of a tour, I'm always in a, you're sort of in your mind is the next show, but I've hardly ever started. I nearly always finish the show before I start the next one. It's in your mind, and you're doing the show thinking, how the fuck did I write this? This is, you know, this is so multi-layered, and everything calls back, and I can never do, every year I think I can't do something as good as that. I can't, how did I, you know, you can't even remember doing it, but it happens very organically, and you mess around with stuff, and the call, I think, you can't force the callbacks and you can't force the connections, but they sort of appear out of nowhere. So it's sort of,
and that's as a result of doing it and saying it out loud and
doing it and then thinking about it, and then, you know, suddenly these, and at its best, my Edinburgh shows, I'll create something on stage that will then either turn into a routine or come out as a routine. I think that kind of white hot heat of being on stage when you're really in the zone, you can create much better than sitting, you know, if you're sitting typing a typewriter to computer, you can do that for days and nothing can happen. If you're really focused, the audience are really behind you, and you hit an idea and then it just goes bang, and you know, you've got either the big start of a routine for tomorrow when you do it the next day, or sometimes the whole thing comes out, or sometimes you grasp that kind of connection to something else that makes it make sense. And so at the moment, you know, some weirdly, like even these very disparate routines I've got at the moment, these, they are, they're, that's all, it's sort of starting to swirl around. It's like a, you know, there's a universe thing where it's swirling around the centre, and then suddenly it kind of comes and forms into a planet or a sun or something, and it sort of starts to work. And I'm at that stage now where it feels, you know, 3 weeks away, that it feels like I'm on the edge of maybe finding out how this show's going to be.
But
there's loads of things I haven't even tried out yet.
And from the raw starting point, so you... Are you just sort of thinking about stuff and then taking that thinking onto the stage? Are you writing bullet points? Are you writing out longhand?
It changes different with each one. Like this year's show, I think the reason the show's going a bit slower is because a lot of them are blogs that I'm then reading out, because they're quite complicated and densely written and sort of need to be. I haven't got off the paper with them yet.
Okay.
But sometimes, like with the Oh Fuck I'm 40, I remember I just went on and told the story about how I had a fight the day before, basically the first preview. I didn't have anything to talk about, and then I just told this story, and I came off stage and went, well, yeah, that was too long and it needs a joke there and there and there, but actually this is a really good
matter, isn't it?
You know, I've told the story, and then by then doing it over a few nights, usually 5 or 6 nights, I think you kind of, it starts to become a routine, and then but you keep chipping away at it. I never give up. I never think that's perfect. Once it gets to the stage where you're on tour, a lot of it's trying to work out how's the best way to say each word and what tone and what speed and what volume.
Okay.
And just the cadence of it, and see if I slow down here or change the emphasis, can I make this joke work better? But I'm constantly right at the end still trying to improve and come up with new stuff.
Okay.
And usually that won't be very much, and usually it'll be about just noticing one day, going, that joke isn't going as well as it can, what can I do with it till tomorrow? And then I won't think about it until I get to it the next day, and then go, oh yeah, I was going to think about this, and then I'll try something else. And then it does become more like a song. It becomes, you know, Talking Cock especially, I've done it so many times, but I was still coming up with stuff, but it was, you know, there's bits that become very much like, I know exactly how this has to go for this to work as well as it can. But some bits, but even then sometimes you go, I'm bored, let's try and see if I say it in a different way, or changing a word can turn it around. But right at the beginning, I think it's just about, you know, it varies. Sometimes it's going on and going, well, let's take a pump with this story. So like I ad-libbed a thing in one of the Leicester Square Theatre podcasts of about Nelson Mandela and Prince Philip, which I've never written down, And then that's become just a little routine that I can do at the moment. I don't know if I'll be able to do it if even them do die. But, you know, that's completely off paper and I've got it. And it's I don't know how it came about. I don't know either, but I know all the bits that have to be in it. Whereas some of the other bits are kind of long things I've written that I still haven't kind of got my head around. And then I think once you're off paper, you can really start dicking around with it. But yeah, I mean, even last night there was that scene, but I keep forgetting to record it. And then I don't listen back to if I do record. So there's loads of bits that come up.
That's familiar. You
hit and you've got something, and then you completely forget about them.
Yeah.
Usually, if they're good enough, they seem to come back in your head sometimes. I mean, sometimes I forget a whole routine that I've been doing in a stand up set, and then for months, and then go, oh, God, how come I'm not doing that bit anymore?
Sure.
I just forgot that it existed.
Your persona on stage, Richard Herring, the comedian.
Yeah.
What's the difference? What are the key differences between you, the person, and you, the comedian?
I think increasingly not that much with the stand-up shows. He's a bit more pedantic and, you know, and I guess I pretend to... I really like to take an idea and that's a bit pedantic or stupid and follow it through. So at the moment I'm doing a bit about... when people jumped out of the World Trade Center, some people argued they'd committed suicide when the, you know, obviously when the planes hit. Do you remember that? Because they committed suicide, they'd go to hell, and that wouldn't. Right. I wouldn't have said that if I thought that. I would have kept quiet about it. But so I'm doing a routine about that. But I kind of like taking the logic. And so the logic of the comedian, the character on stage, is to say that the people who stayed inside the building committed suicide because at least there was some hope. If you jumped out, you might jump out, land on a lot.
Yes, got you. Okay.
So I don't think that. But I then, you know, so that's different than me. But I like taking that parenting point and turning it around and then going, no, actually, it's the people the firemen and stuff who stayed inside the building, they committed suicide by being in a fire. Yeah. And not trying to escape from it, so I think they've all gone to hell. So it's taking that idea and turning it around.
Yeah.
So I obviously don't think that, but it's kind of fun to. So it's fun to be a character who think, you know, I suppose even that liberals racist thing. It's the character espousing a ridiculous idea that I don't think in order to make a point about something.
That's interesting. What do you think what do you feel your status is when you're on stage dealing with the crowd? And the reason I ask, sort of what I'm trying to get at here is, I for a couple of years was in for as many years I was in a street performing double act, and for a couple of years I was in a sketch show / stand up sort of double act. And in both of those situations, I found that the dynamic of the double act often ended up with me being almost if not a straight man, but a straighter man than I'd anticipated.
Yeah.
And it kind of, I sort of felt like, oh, I like being solo because I'm the whip smart one. I'm the best one in the room. But often what I discovered of my strongest suit, you know, the funniest truth about me, if you like, when working with someone else, I sort of ended up being the lower status one.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wondered about you look back at photos of the double act with you and Stu, he was looking cool and flicking his hair around and smoking a cigarette, and you seemed happy to play what you previously called, you know, the character of Richard Herring.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just wonder how, if that was the sort of, if that relationship was the crucible of you performing up and down the country on stages, how much of your persona now was formed in having to be the less cool one?
I think less. I think the problem for me coming out of the double act after having... Because weirdly, when we started off, when we did university, I was probably the highest status character. I played all the highest status characters, and I was the kind of cocky, sarcastic one in it. And then for whatever reason, I can't remember why we did it this way, but I kind of actually had some knocks for my first couple of fringes, and I think I actually lost that cockiness that I'd been... And the sarcasm and stuff, and actually, I think probably I became a bit of a lower status person, and then we kind of realised that would work better in the double act, I suppose, and the sort of versions of ourselves. But having come out of it, I kind of felt that I, you know, Stuart was able to be Stuart in either, really. The Stuart Lee in the double act wasn't that different than the Stuart Lee stand up stuff. And Stuart was much more committed to his solo stuff even then. And so it was, you know, we were both writing all of it. So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like I was writing my stupid bits and he was writing
his stuff.
So we were both writing all of it. But I felt, you know, I had to recreate something pretty different. I mean, there are elements of that, the sort of sex obsession and the slight perverse element again, which isn't really. I'm quite obsessed with sex, so that's true, but I'm not. I'm very sort of vanilla and straight-laced, so I'm very different. I don't like having sex with animals and drinking their milk or any of that stuff. But it's also fun to play around with, you know, that idea that you're trying to cover some horrible secret or something that you've got. But so I felt I had to rediscover what I was going to be on stage without Stu. And I think both of us, there's an element where the other one still plays a part in our. We often, both of us still have conversations within our solo stuff in which, certainly in studio,
he
does my voice when he's being stupid and he's doing a stupid conversation. And we'd certainly both do, you know, that similar sort of thing. Because we've learned to do comedy together and we learn from each other. It's sort of, I mean, I think that's the odd thing about it, that certainly when I started doing stand-up again, and I knew this would be an issue, but people... Even journalists were going, oh, you know, it's very derivative of Stuart Lee. You know, you're kind of going, well, what's to say Stuart Lee isn't derivative of me? You know, you don't know who came up with this stuff. So, I wouldn't mind if people said it's like Lee and Herring, but like sometimes people were going, it's like Stuart Lee.
Yes.
Almost like they either didn't know we'd work together or that they just, because they'd seen Stuart doing solo stand-up first, that meant he'd done that first.
Yes.
So that was, I kind of felt I had to kind of get away from that. And there were times where I was thinking, well, I really like this routine, but it's a bit too much like something Stuart would do, even though, you know, possibly the thing that Stuart did. So something like the All Things Bright and Beautiful sketch that Stuart used to do came out of me laughing at All Things Bright and Beautiful. Okay. I told him pretty much all of the aspects of that song that were ridiculous. He was sort of singing going, what are you laughing? And I was just laughing all the way through the song.
Okay.
I explained what I thought was funny about it. And I would just have left. I wouldn't have thought of doing a routine about it. He took it away and made it into an amazing routine, and you know, and pulled the Venn diagrams and stuff in it. Yeah. And really made it work. But you know, we both had that kind of same pedantic ideas. You know, so that. But it's impossible to say who created what in that. But I was aware that I had to kind of try and get away from that, because he would just as I was starting to come back to stand up, Stu suddenly became the most successful stand up in the country. So that was kind of an odd place to be. So I was trying to get away as much as possible from that. But I was just using, I think to begin with, I was pretty frustrated and lonely and, you know, wondering where my life was going. So a lot of the early stuff's kind of quite midlife crisis-y, and some of it's quite angry and unpleasant. I couldn't, you know, some people say, oh, you should go back and do all your shows one every, you could do, you know, 25 shows in 25 days, all the different ones. But I think like a lot of those early shows, I couldn't really even do them again, because I'm not that, you know, the Menage a Un, even though if I come 40, think it's not me anymore, that person isn't who I am. So I've just gone with, you know, I've sort of let where I am in my life dictate what the personality of the show is. And there's bits, I think inevitably you look back at a show you did 10 years ago and go, I wouldn't do that joke anymore. I'm embarrassed that I did that joke. But then the me of 10 years ago thought it was a good idea to do it. So I don't want to kind of say, I would still defend the joke, even if I don't like it now, because I think that was the decision that younger man made about what he was trying to do. So I think there was a bit of anger and a bit of frustration. And then as I got kind of more happy within myself, it sort of changed. So I think it's just flowing with who I am. So I think there is a lot more of me in it. And I think I think with the What Is Love Anyway, that show was nearly all completely true stories, just told completely straight. The only thing that was, I mean, it still came out a true thing was the thing where I said I've got off with my dry cleaners, because they had a thing saying, like, we love our customers. I didn't get off with them, but all the rest of it is, all the rest of that is true, you know, but it was just a load of true stories. So it's, I think it's just about mining myself and trying to be as honest as I can about myself, I suppose.
Is there anything that you don't mind? Is there anything that you... I don't mean sort of salacious stuff that's off limits so much as... Is there anything that hurts too much to talk about? Is there anything... Because, I mean, or does it hurt? Is any of the process painful of letting yourself be so undignified sometimes? Yeah, do you know what I mean?
It is. I think it's... The difficult thing is just building up to do it. And so I think a lot of the better things I've done, a lot of the more successful routines I've done, I've really... been resistant to do them because I'm a bit scared of either revealing something. There's a bit in maybe If I Come 40 where I talk about getting a blowjob off a girl and me saying, yeah, that's right, suck my big cock, and she goes, well, average size cock. But I was, for ages, I was really couldn't bring myself to do it, just because I would have to admit that I had said suck my big cock, and I thought that was really embarrassing that I uttered that phrase.
It's interesting, isn't it? The stuff you don't want to say, that's what we want to hear, isn't it?
But then, of course, and I think I've realised this through all the things I've done, but certain stuff like talking cock and anything that's sort of slight revelatory, everyone else has the exact same stuff, you know. So everyone has these things that they're ashamed of or worried that people will find out, and they're usually tiny little stupid things. They're not big dark secrets, but people would be, you know, mortified if it came out. But to hear someone else talking about it, that's really with talking cock, just to hear someone else even discussing that an issue exists is so reassuring to people, and that you can laugh at it, so you don't have to go, you can allow to laugh, and then you can go, oh, thank God, you know, this is, it's a laugh of relief, and it's a laugh like, oh, this is okay, everyone's accepting this. So I think there's a real element where by exposing yourself in that way, you A, realise what you're doing isn't that bad. So I think you can really harbour these worries about yourself, and then you realise, I mean, but you just have to look at, if you even thought you were perverted, you just have to look at the internet and go, oh, okay, people want to watch this, so I'm not perverted. You know, I was worried that I'd said to a girl, suck my big cock. Oh, look at the internet. No, I think on the scale of things, that isn't too bad. But, you know, I was genuinely worried about it. But I think the more you do it, the more you lose that embarrassment. And I think I was always open to... I mean, Stu was always got quite much more embarrassed about stuff and more worried about stuff than I did. But there were things that did embarrass me and he worried about. But, yeah, I think you get a better grip on what is acceptable to say as well.
I'm here enjoying part two of this interview. I've only got a couple of things to say pre-Fringe, so I'll get right to it. I've got some Edinburgh recommendations for other people's shows. These are all fairly off-the-wall shows, quite far removed from the usual straight stand-up. So if you want to try something new, you should check out these, which are all personal recommendations of things I've seen that I love, or they're things by people who I've seen be amazing that I'm looking forward to seeing more of. So I was lucky enough the other week to playtest Nightmare Live, which is a live comedy version of the children's television adventure game show that some of you will be lucky enough to remember. It's in very, very funny shape. Tom Bell and Paul Flannery, and amongst others, doing some really good stuff there. So I'm sure that's going to be a big hit at the festival. Likewise, The Dark Room. You've probably heard me talk about The Dark Room before. That's John Robertson's show, the original and best interactive text-based adventure game show captained by an aggressive floating head. I've seen that now in different countries about 7 or 8 times, possibly more. So you mustn't miss The Dark Room. Slapdash Galaxy is a junk shadow puppet clown show. Yeah, that's a genre. That is strikingly beautiful and funny and has got a properly breathtaking 3D shadow puppet finale. So if you're looking for something that you will never have seen before, go and see Slapdash Galaxy. You won't be disappointed. Two slightly sort of fringy, or on the fringe of the fringe, comedians. Matt Ewins is one of them with his show Once Upon a Time in the Jest. Matt's show last year was one of my favourite things, so I can't wait for this one. Very, very strange kind of quasi-character comedy. And also Alistair Green is back with a show called Alistair Green is Jack Spencer Sex Addict. And that is a character show that I cannot wait to see because of the nature of it. By which I don't mean that it's sexy. It may well be sexy, but I think it's going to be an excellent send-up of a certain, shall we say, type of performer. So go and see that. That's Alistair Green is Jack Spencer, Sex Addict. And finally, on the recommendations, Slightly Fat Features, which is a brilliant sort of vaudeville variety gang show that's kind of gleefully mental and riotous, and is the only show on the fringe with Arctic Tigers, and it's sort of like a cross, if you can imagine a cross between Cirque du Soleil and Pappies, you'd be along the right lines. That's done by a lot of my friends from the street performing days, and they're some of the most inspiring, fun and aggravating people you're ever going to meet. So do go and see Slightly Fat Features. That's on at the Pleasance, in Pleasance One, huge venue, so that should be really, really good fun, very atmospheric. Remember to check out the landing page at www.comedianscomedian.com for details of all of the currently released guests that I have on the show this Fringe. The Comedians Comedian Live is, of course, on at 5:15 p.m. daily at the Gilded Balloon, and will feature. I'm just going to zip through all these without explaining who they are, because otherwise I'll be here all day. Hal Cruttendon, Sean Hughes, Brendan Burns, David Baddiel, Greg Proops, Phil Nicol, Tony Law, Andrew Maxwell, Milton Jones, Bo Burnham, Marcus Brigstock, Will Franken, Tim Vine, Ed Byrne, Susan Kalman, Al Murray, Sarah Milliken, Rob Delaney, and Claudia O'Doherty has just been added to that lineup as well, plus a good few more that we're confirming at this very moment. Finally, send me an email or a tweet with your favourite quote from your favourite episode, any things that have particularly stood out in your mind. A good example, the one that I always think of, is Dan Evans in episode 2 saying, "Sometimes I look at the audience and think these people are just ants that turn food into shit." What are your favourites? I want your favourites for some sticker advertising during the Fringe. Let me know your favourites. I'll set to plastering them all over the city, but not in the shape of cocks. When you tweet me, at ComComPod, if you listen to, it is a bit of audience research now, very lastly, if you listen to all of the episodes, tweet me with the hashtag floozy. And if you mainly listen to acts that you already know or that you've already seen before, tweet me with the hashtag choosy. So it's hashtag floozy or choosy. And just let me know and I'll be interested in your listening habits. So that's all the stuff. Comedianscomedian.com for all of the guest information and links to tickets. Now, back to Richard Herring. Do you have elements, do you recognise elements of stand-up that are beyond your reach? Do you see people, do you see other acts doing certain things and going, "I wish, I've just never been very good at doing that"?
I think with comedy, again, as I've got older, I sort of feel like you want to have kind of the whole palette of all the different kinds of stuff. I'm not very good at, I couldn't do a whole show of one-liners, and I kind of admire up to an extent the people who can do that. I think it's amazing. If you can come up with really good one-liners, then that are original, and that is an amazing skill that I don't think I could ever have. You know, if I write one-line joke a year, I'm very, very happy with that, and it's usually still three lines. Mm-hmm. But if I can write just a quick gag, I'm pretty happy. So, but I sort of think it's really easy to sort of think, well, this kind of comedy is good and all the other kind of comedies are bad, or, you know, doing this kind of broad comedy or doing puns is bad or whatever. I actually think I'd really like to get to a stage where I can have a crack at most of it to some extent. And I think in the broad range of doing a good comedy show, that if I do an unexpected pun that's good, it's so unusual that actually that would be pretty, you know, that would be pretty funny, because it's, yeah, because it's, and I don't think it's a bad thing to draw in your audience with a little bit of stuff that you think, the danger is you can go, "Oh no, that joke's a bit hack, or that joke's a bit obvious, or that joke," but actually sometimes you can wrong foot people by doing a joke like that, but also you can draw in some of the people who might go, "Oh, you know, I'm not sure about this guy." You give them a couple of, yeah, slightly easier jokes, and then you can hit them with something else or slightly different jokes. So I think I'm becoming sort of less snobbish about comedy.
Okay.
And therefore I sort of want to have a go at most of it. Yeah, I think I'd struggle to do anything like Jimmy Carr or Gary Delaney does do so well. But I mean, you know, and someone like, you look at someone like Daniel Kitson, you kind of think this is another level that would be hard to get to, but I think it's really good to have those people there, not to, you know, to not to emulate or copy, but just to have that level there that you're thinking, that's how far you can go with this. So,
do you ever suffer from the common thing that comedians suffer from when they watch Daniel Kitson and they go, "Oh God, what's the point?"
Yeah, well, you do. You sort of do feel that, but then I think you also think that's something to. I remember one of the early gigs I did, I saw Reginald D. Hunter come on seeming a little bit drunk or stoned and just talk really in a quiet voice to the audience about some stuff that had just happened, and it really looked like he'd made the whole thing up. He might not have done, but I just thought that would be amazing. At that stage I was very scripted, and I thought that's what I really want to do as a stand-up. I want to be able to go on stage and just talk and be funny for an hour without having anything prepped. And, you know, but I've sort of got to the stage where I can get close to doing that. I mean, usually with someone else I would do now, but all the podcasts I do are completely unscripted, and you tell stories and it's that sort of thing, and it comes out.
Okay, so I'd always assume that the pre-guest stand-up bits that you've done in the past have been scripted, or is that
not much, a little bit. Okay. I've got an idea of what I'm going to say, but okay, I don't write the jokes, I just kind of see what comes out. But yeah, I mean, more so, you know, all with the Andrew Collins things, we would talk for an hour and literally not, I wouldn't, he sometimes would prepare subject matter.
Okay, like, but you wouldn't take in topics.
No, no, no. Okay. So we would just talk, but I haven't done it as a solo stand-up. So I think you just, it's good to have something to aim for, you know. And it's, that seemed impossible to me then, the idea that someone could come on and be that relaxed and that confident. They could talk in a, just a really, you know, it was, he just talked in this really quiet way, so everyone was gripped and had to listen to him, but they did want to listen to him, and he was interesting and funny as well. So that was something I found wanted to do. So I think seeing people do something amazing should hopefully, although it does part of it, you go, oh, but it also should make you go, well, there's places to go, there's places to climb. And even Daniel Kitson, who I don't think has anyone above him at all, actually, but he has to keep on creating, finding that himself. Otherwise, I think you just, you've got to keep pushing and try to get better. And I think that, I really think that's the key to it, is to realise, so I guess that's what I was trying to get at earlier, you know, it's just that however good you think you are, you can always be better. And even if you are really good, you can still be better, and you should be striving to get better. And I think that, and I suppose that not being too successful, not getting drawn into all the other trappings and taken out of it, means that you're more likely to push yourself to do something more interesting.
Have you been in a because of your work writing and then consequently earning the money to buy the house, have you been in a position, presumably, where you can afford to take risks?
Well, I think the problem with, actually, the thing I found with having any kind of security is it makes you really podgy and complacent, and you think, what's the point? So every time I've actually had any money, I've just spent it.
Okay.
Because
deliberately, as a strategy. Yeah.
Well, because that's why I bought this. I bought a house that was too big. There was a point when there was a couple of years at the early point of having this house. It's a nice house that I thought I'm going to have to move out because I'm not earning enough money to sustain the mortgage. So it was a big mortgage. And then I got through that. And then I got to the point a couple of years ago where, again, it was feeling like, oh, actually, you know, I'm close to owning this house. So then I spent some money renovating that. So it's, again, it's not a bad position to be in. You've still got the security of having a house, so I can move and I can move to a flat and be secure. So there's a security there. But I found that, I suppose, you know, not having to fret about where your next meal is coming from and that sort of stuff does mean, you can sort of go, well, I'll take some time doing this. I guess if I was poor or I had no money, then the initial decision to sort of spend 5 years doing podcasts that aren't paid might have seemed like a weird one to me. You know? But I think most, because we both, Stu and I, came from very much a writing background, and we were right, you know, we came to London and we wrote for 3 or 4 years on radio shows, and we wrote hours and hours of radio in the first 3 or 4 years we were doing. And most stand-ups were just in the day, were sitting around playing video games and smoking weed, and then go and do their 20 minutes of.
Sure.
And we had a very strong work ethic, I guess, in terms of writing. And I guess that's why I feel like if I'm not writing in the day, that I'm wasting the day. And sometimes it's hard to remember that what I do at night is a job, and it's hard work, and it's much harder work than you kind of think it would be. Like, so, you know, doing those Leicester Square Theatre podcasts for 2 hours is so draining and exhausting in front of an audience. So sometimes you forget that the nighttime stuff's work. But so I think I can't quite remember where I was going, but I felt like, you know, you got to make the most of all your day. But obviously, having some security means that you can, play snooker against yourself, and certain knowledge that is not going to really make any money anytime soon, or just see where you go with stuff. But I think as a comedian, you've got to take risks. And even if you're, and I've been a poor comedian, I've been a comedian without funds, and it's still like much, much better than working. And it's still, you've still got a lot of time. The fact, if you've got no money, you've got even more time to sit down and you've literally got hunger to write. So you've got all
that.
Did
any part of you feel like you should be doing a proper job? Have you ever stopped and thought, what am I doing? Okay, I've nailed this in terms of my ability to support myself by dicking around, effectively.
I know, it feels very odd. I mean, my family were very, my dad's, oh, they're all teachers, and my dad's got this very strong ethic of work and decency, and it felt really, the first couple of years where I was not having to even do any temp work or anything else to begin, we were doing little jobs, but not very much. And then we just took the leap and thought, fuck it, I'll have no money and just make this work somehow. But the first couple of years of just being able to go on the tube in the daytime when people were at proper work, I felt like this awful mixture of guilt and excitement and feeling like this is so wrong, and I still get it a little bit, but it's easy to sort of forget that. So those days when you're sitting at home watching TV or just failing or just too hungover or just too tired to write and you're feeling terrible, you know, that's still what a fucking luxury to spend, you know, even if it ended tomorrow, I've spent 25 years of my life not having to go in.
It is only right that now you go to a salt mine.
Yeah. So, you know, I completely appreciate it, and I have done jobs, and I know how awful that is, but once you get used to it, and it's so great being your own boss, and it's so great. There's a lot of downside to it, and you know, and I made a lot of sacrifices, and I didn't have any money for 10 or 15 years at all, and didn't have any kind of social life or married life, or, you know, I was flitting around. It's kind of very hard to get into proper relationships and stuff. So you've given away a lot to get what you've got, but then you can do all of those things and still be okay.
Just to go back briefly to the subject of other comics and sort of other comedy styles and things like that. Just the flip side of the coin, I should have asked before, is there anything you see that you can't stand? I'm not asking you to name names, but in terms of styles or tropes or certain things that people do.
I mean, I like it. I almost respect anyone who can make a living out of this job, nearly. And there are a few exceptions, but I think if you're able to do this job and keep working, people keep paying to see you and you keep making them laugh, then you're doing something right.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm much more personally into people who are doing something original. So I just don't like the much more formal. In stand-up, there's a lot of very formulaic stand-up that I think... Mm-hmm. You just go, this is, you know, you can just see the same basic act over and over again. You kind of think, well, why, if you're doing this job, why not try and do your own joke, you know? So you're hit. I mean, also, I think when you see comics doing jokes that people are doing on Twitter, that civilians are doing on Twitter, you kind of think, that shouldn't be part of your act, because that is, you know, if a person can think of that joke, then that's why are you going on stage telling, you know? So I saw someone out last night, I think, doing... let's say it was, it probably wasn't this one, but let's say it was the Andy Murray is British because he won and not Scottish, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that joke is so well worn, and you know, and you kind of think, well, how could you put that in your act? How could you put that in your stand-up act? You must know that other people have done that. So I think anyone who's trying to do something original or groundbreaking, or even just, you know, someone who can take those formulas and twist them on their head, something like Booby Graffo does lots of those formulaic jokes, but in such a way that even a comedian can't spot what's going to happen
next.
And so that's what, if you're artful with it, it sort of is. There are a lot of jokes are just magic tricks, and if you know the trick, you can make it work and you can adapt it to different situations. It's a very similar thing, but if you can actually fool comedians with your pullback and reveal joke by making it good enough that the feed line is a brilliant joke in itself, and then you surprise people, and that's basically what comedy is. It's just about surprising people with something that's near to its essence. So, you know, I think there are ways to still do entertaining stuff, and I don't have a problem with people like McIntyre, to a lesser extent. I have a bit of a problem with Peter Kay, but McIntyre does what he does, and it's a really difficult thing to do that kind of observational comedy in a way that a mass audience is still going to find it funny, and to be it, to found your own little niche in it. It's such a well mined area that for anyone to find their own little area in it and make it successful and keep doing that for years is very, really impressive. I guess
just what's different about Peter Kay?
I think it's slightly he does in a very charming way, and he's an amazing performer. To me, it feels like he's got a lot of talent under there that he's just not really using, because when you see some of his written stuff, you go, oh, there's a lot more to you than this. But he's doing stuff that I'd expect to hear from my friends if I went to the pub and they go, do you remember that TV show? Yeah. And it'd be really entertaining to do that with your friends. So he's taking on that kind of role when I think there's more to him. And I just feel he's I think I've done a couple of my old shows again, but I think it's when you feel like someone's just peddling out the same thing for too long and just resting on your laurels a bit. But that's what I mean. If you earned £30 million last year, it'd be pretty hard
to buy a lot of laurels. Comfy laurels.
Do you want to come out to knock two bang and do 5 minutes? No, I think I'll stay in my palace and, you know, eat quail's eggs. Which I imagine. But you know, I still have a lot of admiration for him, because I think it's really difficult to become that successful a comedian and be that populist. I don't have a problem being popular. You know, Morecambe and Wise are probably one of my favourite comedy acts, and they're the most popular comedy act in the country, and they were brilliant. So they, you know, I think you can be both. But yeah, it's just unoriginality. I can't understand why you would take this job, do this job, and then just trot out stuff that anyone could do, and that other people do. But I think you've got to keep an open mind about stuff. I think it's very easy to, you know, just be dismissive of stuff. And the minute you're with comedy, what's quite amazing about Jack Carroll doing well on Britain's Got Talent is that's the least comedy-friendly environment you get, because it's a room full of people, as you're coming on, sitting there going, come on then, be funny, which is impossible. And obviously it's slightly disarming that this is a young disabled lad. He's 14 years old, which helps, and he's a disabled lad, which means it's hard to be, come on, you fucking cunt. But he's very, very good as well, which makes a big difference. But that's a very hard environment to be good at. If you're coming into a situation and an audience doesn't want to laugh at you, that's a very hard thing to come into. So I think it's about opening up your preconceptions and kind of allowing stuff in. But I mean, that, you know, I don't, there's kind of this sort of broad comedy, this broad 1970s comedy that seems to be coming back into vogue, I feel it's a bit disappointing, just in terms of just sort of being a throwback and not in a very imaginative way, I think. Again, I never saw Mrs. Brown's Boys. The first time I saw it, I really hated it. And the second or third time I saw it, I sort of had a grudging admiration for him. I guess there's an element where Axe is stealing other people's material, which he does a little bit, certainly in the early series, which I don't like. But he does joke, you know, he does joke. Almost public arena jokes.
Gotcha.
But some of them are other people's jokes in the early days, anyway. So I don't like that, but you know, even that, I think there's something in it. If people have worked that hard, and they've really worked hard to build that franchise and that idea, and as much as it's not my kind of thing, I kind of admire them for doing that. And it's interesting that that's what it's taken. You know, it's taken someone to do his own thing for 10 years and then to be taken on TV. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of positives you can take out of that.
Sure.
But it's sort of, you know, it seems. That seems a bit odd, but yeah.
What do you anticipate happening from comedy over the next 5, 10, 15 years? Do you perceive there's a crisis in it? Do you perceive there's too much supply for the available demand, you know?
I think there probably is too much supply. I think it all just goes in ebbs and flows. It's just hawks and doves, isn't it? It's just that's pretty much everything in the world works on that principle. If there are too many hawks, then the hawks die out because there aren't enough doves to feed them, and then they become too many doves, and then the hawks recover. So it just goes back and forth. It's a pendulum thing, and I don't think, you know, the thing is, if it gets to the point where 10,000 people are trying to do comedy, there aren't enough venues to do it, and there aren't enough people to pay for it, so that will, some of those people will drop out, and some of the people will realise that actually you can't become a multimillionaire in 2 years. So those kind of people will fall away. I think it's incredibly healthy. I think you can concentrate on different aspects of it and make it look like anything you want it to look like. I think the sort of alternative side of the circuit is so strong. And again, despite what Stuart Lee says, he's on TV. He's got two shows on TV, you know, that showcase this kind of comedy. So that's pretty incredible in itself. That you don't need a big agent to get on TV, because there he is on TV, and there's his and these more alternative people on TV. But I think that's really interesting. I think the podcasting stuff, the make your own stuff, is really exciting and interesting way to go. I think it will just become easier and easier for people to make their own stuff, and I think people will start to find ways to make money out of it directly if they need to. But I don't think you even need to make it directly. I think you'll make it eventually. I think people, you know, if you just create good stuff and you create a demand, then you will make money eventually if you're good. So I think that can actually shut people up, because you can't sit at home going, oh, well, if only they put me on TV, I'd be doing a brilliant TV show, because you can actually do it yourself. So yeah. you certainly can do a radio show on your own. You and I could make a radio show now with our two recorders.
Yeah.
And it would be fine. It would sound okay. So, I think that freedom and that autonomy is really exciting. I think TV will become less important, because I think the way we ingest media will be about, which is already happening really, you know, it's downloads, it's Netflix, it's this, it's that. It's not, when you're not actually sitting around a TV waiting for something to come on, it's just, there'll be all these different ways of viewing things. But it's hard to know how really young people will want to ingest comedy, and that's how it changes. So if young people decide they're not going to pay for anything, or then, you know, then that model of stuff won't work, or if just they decide to do something other than watch TV. I used to watch TV all the time, and then now I don't really watch it. I watch DVDs, sometimes tape something off the TV, but mainly I'm on the computer ingesting stuff through the computer. So it's very hard to say what it'll be like in 10 years time, because 10 years ago you could not have anticipated what we're doing now.
No, absolutely.
Who knows what it'll be in 10 years time, but I think, you know, the basic cheapness of doing all of this stuff, doing these things I'm doing with Go Faster Strike, I think someone more ambitious and could take this a long way. I feel it's similar to the boom in the movie business in 1910s, and the sort of Charlie Chaplin thing. If you could get someone who understands the internet well enough that they could become, the way Charlie Chaplin became a millionaire almost immediately, because everyone was paying 1p to go to the cinema to see these new films. It's exactly the same, you know. You get 100,000 listeners if they all pay you £10 a year to do something. You're a millionaire. And I think if people start to see it that way, and I think they might do, that, you know, people can start to, you know, create their own little media empires and do their own thing. And so I think someone a bit younger than me with a bit more of a hunger to become someone rich, I think you can become very rich doing this if you've got the talent to do it, then, you know, I think someone could really sort of blow it wide open. But I think, you know, just the very idea that Netflix is, and some of these other companies, are making their own TV shows. All they're doing is giving people the money to make what they want to do and then putting on their thing. That's very exciting. I just think
convention. Are you going to approach those sorts of
things? I've sort of been trying to, yeah. I mean, a couple of my DVDs, my live DVDs, are on Netflix, and I thought they'd be, I think they're just a bit inundated with stuff. I thought if Netflix would say, you know, they don't even have to give me very much money, to be honest. If they came through the autumn, they could. I wouldn't like to say how much it is, just in case they're listening.
Sure.
But it wouldn't be, you know, they could probably give me, if that happened that way, then that's another way of doing it, isn't it? So then that's, people say, oh, would you be sponsored for stuff? And I might be if the right thing came along, but I also really, I would love to be able to do this just with the aid of the people at home, you know. So it really is just a kind of democratic, well, not even kind of democratic, because it can still be a tiny minority of people, but it just means they're in control of whether this exists or not, and if it's good enough and they like it, it'll continue to exist if they're happy to give a small amount of money to it. But it's, you know, you're talking about a cup of coffee, you're saying, let's say, rather than going to Starbucks this afternoon, give me that money and I'll make a TV show for you. And if enough people did that, and people thought of it that way, then, you know, they're happy to pay £3 for a cup of coffee, but not happy to pay £3 for an hour and a half of entertainment. So it's just about switching people's brains a little bit and making them think about that. And I think what I've got is the people who listen to my stuff trust me, know that I'm honest about it, and know that I'm not trying to rip them off. And I can understand that you'd be, well, what if there's some scam involved in this, or what if, you know. But they know, I think they know I'm upfront about it, and it's not, and they trust me that I'm interested in making the stuff around, because they know that I've done it, because I spent 5 years making the stuff without them asking them for a penny. So I think if I can just convince people to come around to that myself, then that's a different way of doing things. So, you know, I think it's very exciting. I think it's, and I think it's Michael McIntyre and that lot, and all those, you know, these, but she's talking about people with agents have stitched up the entertainment industry as if the people with agents are just some chumps off the street who've walked in off. The people who've got agents and big management behind them are great comedians who've been snapped up by agents. They're all good, as far as I can see. So it's not like it's a trick or there's some kind of elite. It's just that some good people are being represented by people. There may be an element where TV selects certain types of people, and that's a bit unfair on other types of people, but that's something. But, you know, it's good that Michael McIntyre's roadshow exists, just as it's good that Stuart Lee's, whatever his Comedy Central thing's called, exists, because, you know, you get a variety of all these different stuff, and it's only Michael McIntyre's only the same as Des O'Connor and Jimmy Tarbuck, you know, in comedy terms, was in the 1970s. You know, there was that kind of comedian. Then there was, in the 70s, you were sort of getting Billy Connolly and Jasper Carrot and stuff on the outskirts of it. And the 1980s, you had this different group of people. The whole point of that alternative stuff is that it's never going to be massively mainstream. So it's, but it's a, there's a really vibrant, exciting scene going on there, I think. And you know, I think Edinburgh, it's expanding much too much, Edinburgh, and something's going to burst. And it's, last year was very difficult for everyone in the middle. But then it will just adapt, and that's what I'm not one of those people who looks back and goes, oh, and I think Stu is one of those people who looks back. Stu kind of wants to be, he wishes he hadn't gone to Oxford, and he was
okay.
He was in the 1980s alternative comedy boom, and he wants the whole world to still be like that, which is fine, and what he's doing is great. But I think it's great that Edinburgh changes, and I think it will change, and it will ebb and flow as it's meant to do, and things will come and things will go, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't want to sit there and go, oh, Edinburgh was much better in 1987 when I was 19. It was great then. We could get drunk every night, kiss girl, because things change. No, you change as well as the place, but I don't think it's, if things, some things become more corporate, and loads of things have become much less corporate. So the Free Fringe is more alternative than anything we were doing in the early 90s. So that's an amazing thing. And there's the Stand there if you want to go to the Stand. So there's much more choice. So it's a great thing. And the things that are good and the things that people will like and find out about will get through. Loads of good people will not get what they deserve. You know, that's what you've got to realise. It's not...
That was being said like a very optimistic message
not,
at the end.
Well, it's not like fair, but I think it's not a fair system. So someone who is really good as a stand-up, but also they might be good at stand-up and not any good on TV. So it's not, sure, the two things are different skills. There's every chance that someone could have, you know, just not get spotted and give up, or not get spotted and carry on and still not get spotted. I think if you up your odds of being successful if you just keep battling on and keep going, and also you become much better, and the longer you can leave being discovered and getting onto TV is actually the better, except that TV tends to fit young people.
Yeah.
But I think increasingly won't. I think it also increasingly as the population gets older, there'll be much more room for older comics as well, because there's actually less young people, and loads of old people are going to be in this position where there's lots of pensioners and a massive generation of pensioners. That's what's going to fuck the country up, basically. That's why the NHS can't really survive. It's because there's going to be just thousands and thousands of old people and no one to look after them. A doctor was saying that actually without immigration there's going to be a whole generation of old people with nobody to look after them if we don't have people who are prepared to come in our country and actually do some work. The immigrants will come in and look after them. So ironically, all these kind of old BNP UKIP people will be looked after by Polish people and Nigerian people, because there'll be no one in our country because there aren't enough young people. So that's going to skew everything as well. So you know, you can't guess what the future will bring, but I think the change is good, and it's great that they're, I sort of in a way fear for someone who would be like me starting up now, go, how do you get discovered? How do you break through? How do you do stuff? But I think it's, and we had a very, in a way, we had a very easy ride through that. And it was sort of easy. There were less people doing it. But then the fact there are more people doing it, I wish Lee and Herring had had another 5 years before we were on TV, really.
Right.
I think if we probably wouldn't have carried on working for each other that long. But I think if we'd had 5 more years, A, I'd have appreciated what, you know, we had this amazing thing, we had 4 BBC Two series. It just felt like the, you know, that's what was normal, that should happen. So I didn't really appreciate what we had. I look back at it, it doesn't feel like me even. And I think with another 5 years, we'd have been a bit more experienced, we'd have done a bit better in working at how the shows could go together. Bit less adventurous maybe, and we just tried to cram everything into these. We could have made that material last for a lot longer, and so it's not a bad thing that you're forced to fight your way through the competition, I don't think, but it's hard, makes it hard, but then it's a hard job this year. It's a very hard thing to make a living at, and it's a very hard thing to be discovered, and it's quite hard to be good at. So it's not a bad thing if there's also competition, and the people who are, you know, hungry for it, a force to get through, I suppose.
Great.
Okay.
That'll do us.
Thanks, Matt.
So that's all for now. I'm very grateful to Richard for being so frank and taking so much time out to talk to me when he had some very important snooker to be getting along with. Thanks also to Ben Lund Conlon, who, as you know, is acting as head skivvy for the podcast and doing lots of boring, painful, dull, repetitive, time-consuming tasks very, very efficiently. Thank you, Ben. Thanks, as ever, to Graham Crockford and Dan Melrose, comedianscomedian.com, for all of the Ed Fringe listings for this show. I do hope you'll come and see it. I will talk to you, I think, once more before we get to the Fringe, so I'll speak to you then.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.